Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Lonely Guru podcast. Thanks for tuning in. My guest this episode is Carolyn Cowan. Carolyn is a Kundalini yoga teacher and psychotherapist. She runs regular classes, workshops, and teacher trainings, focusing on overcoming addictions, empowering women, conscious sexuality, and lots more. She has an enormous amount of articles and videos online if you're interested in her work. You can go to carolyncowan.com. Before we start, I'd like to invite you to support this podcast. If you're a fan, you can go to iTunes and rate it and review it. Pass it on to your friends. Share it on social media. I always love to hear what you think. Feel free to send me suggestions, recommendations, comments, questions, and I will incorporate them into future episodes. Here's my conversation with Carolyn Cowan. Hello, everybody. I'm here today with Carolyn Cowan. It's very nice to meet someone in person. I'm usually doing these interviews over the phone or over Skype or something. So we're sitting face to face. It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, it's always lovely to see you.
Yeah. Well, I'm very intrigued by you.
No pressure.
You're quite a radiant woman.
That's very nice, thank you.
And you carry yourself as if you had a full life.
I am still having a full life. My life is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to talking to you and finding out more about you and what you do.
I'm quite nervous. I don't know what you're going to ask me.
So let's just start. Like, where do you come from, and what's your background? What's your history?
Where do I come from? I was born in Chelsea, actually. So every time I walk from Victoria to try yoga, it's a journey through my childhood. Mm-hmm. My father was a 60s fashion photographer, and they used his studio to film a very infamous 60s film called Blow Up. Mm-hmm. Antonioni. They filmed that in his studio. And as a child, I was a model. And actually, as a child, they made a mannequin. Adele Rutstein made a mannequin of me. And I was in all the shops, including Harrods. And when my mother was really pissed off, she would take me to Harrods and look wistfully at this mannequin of me and say, "I wish you were still like that." So My father left when I was a kid, and my mother met and married somebody else, and we left London and moved to live on a farm on the top of a hill in the middle of a forest. And it wasn't a particularly fantastic experience. Mm. And I eventually...
Why not?
My stepfather didn't like anything that wasn't his. Okay. And still doesn't. Particularly didn't like me. And so I was sent away to Catholic boarding school, and I wasn't a Catholic. And Catholic boarding school in the 70s was the stuff of novels. It was standing up in class and being told that nobody could speak to me because I was a Protestant and I would burn in hell forever. But the same man would let me smoke cigarettes and drink alcohol in his house. He was known as the kissing bandit. Yeah, but he only liked very young girls, so most of us were fine. and it was an interesting experience, actually. We had to get dressed. I think a lot of it did guide how I've ended up in my career. We weren't allowed to look at our bodies. We were only allowed to wash, to bathe once a week. Mm. And we used to have to get dressed facing the corner, stand in a corner with a dressing gown over our shoulders. And if we were caught looking at our bodies, we got detention.
Wow.
Yeah, and but if I let a nun watch me bath, I could have as many baths as I wanted. So it was an interesting experience. It got closed down, and then it became Sotheby's in Billingshurst. It was a very, very, it was a very unpleasant experience, very very unpleasant experience, but that's okay. I started running away from school to go and find my father, who left when I was a kid.
Do you feel like you've recovered from that, or?
I think, I don't know if you recover. I collect Catholic iconography.
Mm-hmm.
I collect iconography. It doesn't have to be Catholic, but I do have a large collection of iconography. I think it's really interesting. One gets suddenly into a conversation about feminism, particularly in the light of things like Kundalini yoga. I am a feminist, and I think that has partly come about because of early religious experiences where men are making dictates about how women should be. And I think we can get into a very political conversation about the realms of yoga, particularly Kundalini yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, who is one as a woman? What are you trying to say as a female teacher? And who are you saying it to? It's obviously I'm very happy if you want to sidestep all of that, because it's an interesting landscape. But did I get over it? I think that it has informed my early experiences on many, many levels, have very much informed how I now live my life and who I respond to and what I say. And actually, I do actually run a women's group called For Whose Gaze Do You Stand?
Mm-hmm.
As in G-A-Z-E, who's looking at you when
mm-hmm.
you speak.
Mm-hmm.
So I run a women's group for female women who are teaching women to be able to really consider what are they saying and whose words are they saying,
mm-hmm.
which is quite an interesting way of approaching teaching.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Mm.
Well, I would love to get into that. Before we get into the yoga side of it, I just want to hear a little bit more, like, how did you come to be a yoga teacher? Tell me a little bit more about your path leading up to...
Okay, so I started running away from school when I was about 15 to find my father, and came up to London to look for him. And had the kind of experiences that I wouldn't want my daughter to have.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I met my father, who I didn't know at the time had come back to England to die of lung cancer. So I only met him about 3 times, and it wasn't at all positive. He'd left us and had no interest. So that was a very difficult thing to deal with. And I dealt with it by taking lots of drugs. You know, there was a lot of cocaine around, there were a lot of marijuana. Things were very different. People used drugs and drank very differently, I think, then.
Mm-hmm.
Now everyone's quite different in the way they use. But so I actually left home when I was 16 to live with a musician. So I met a musician. We met in Brighton, and I stayed out all night. When I came home, my mother said, I'm gating you. You can't go out for 6 months. And I said, well, actually, I'm leaving home. And I left. And that's what I did. I left
mm-hmm.
home and lived with a musician for 4 years. And then by that point, I had decided I wanted originally to paint on walls. I wanted to be a muralist.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody was going to teach me. But the day that I was due to start with them, they got a job in America. It never happened. The musician I was living with was working with a punk band, and so I started painting on the lead singer's face, a woman, an Italian woman. And we would stay up all night, and I would paint on her face in between playing backgammon all night with Vangelis. Had a really interesting time of interesting people. And it was the time when all the club scenes started with Steve Strange and Boy George. London mm-hmm. was really, really fascinating. I was a punk, and... I used to paint on this woman's face with Caran d'Ache paints, and then I started working with Steve Strange, and then I finally decided, left the musician, wanted to be a body painter. And I didn't have any money, and it wasn't going how I wanted it to go. And I'd managed to go from one challenging relationship straight into another, so I sold all my clothes in a second-hand shop in Chelsea and bought a plane ticket to Milan and didn't have anywhere to stay and didn't have any money. And discovered that the day I'd booked the ticket for, these Italian punks were going to live in New York. So I got into Milan not knowing anybody. Met somebody on the plane, a young woman, who said, you can stay at my house, my father will help you find somewhere. And he did, he was lovely. Found me a pensione, and I literally went and knocked on the door of Italian Vogue. Age 22, no money, no clothes, apart from what I was wearing. And they booked me every day for 3 months, there and then. And so I stayed in Milan. It was actually completely hideous. It was really, it was so lonely. And the life of working with all these very famous photographers and all these very beautiful, very thin women and the drug issues, it was a very difficult time. It was, it made my career. It made me as a body painter. And I also, Vogue used to pay, I think they still do, £35 a day. So I lived off £35 a day, bought all my drugs and all my clothes. I had a thing for Kenzo at the time. He was quite trendy. I used to be a punk in Kenzo clothes. And he's an interesting designer. Then he was a very interesting designer. So I spent all my money. And so I sold all my credits, which means I went to a hairdresser called Coppola, and I sold them my credits. So every time I appeared in Vogue, it said Carolyn Cowan at Coppola, which meant I then made another £35 a day. So it was, I learned early on to maximise my opportunities. Mm-hmm. Came back to London and was a body painter. And my first pop video, one of my first pop videos actually was an ABC video. There was a band in the 80s, a new romantic band called ABC. Mm-hmm. And I came back from Italy with all these amazing pictures, went to see... Somebody said, oh, go and see this director. They're doing pop videos. So I turned up and the producer said, it was early in the morning, and she said, oh, we can't see you now because we're filming, but do you want to be an extra? I was a bit novice at filming. I didn't know what that meant. So I said, yes. So they dressed me up as a nun in stilettos and put me on a harness, and I'm flying out of a bush on an ABC video called The Look of Love. I'm the opening aria that comes up. But this video company were very successful, and they liked me. And so my first pop video was Brian Ferry. Mm-hmm. My next one was Toya, with the birds coming out of her eyes. And then I did I Want to Break Free with Freddie Mercury. And then I did I'm Still Standing with Duran Duran. And it was just this litany. I just had was in the right place at the right time and just stepped into this whole world of of absolutely extraordinary experiences. I mean, really, really extraordinary experiences with amazing people. And so I did that for a very long time.
So you're grateful for those experiences?
Yeah, it was an amazing... It's an amazing view of life. I went from pop videos into commercials, working on TV commercials, and that was, again, travelling all over the world. You know, Bounty in the West Indies, and just really sort of mad Audi commercials, you know, when they started that whole Vorsprung durch Technik in really mad places. And... yeah. And then I crashed. I was taking so many drugs and drinking so much and so disconnected. I ended up in Dublin, actually, doing a shoot with David Bowie. I competed against all the makeup artists in the world and got this job. Turned up in Ireland. I smuggled drugs into Ireland. I was drinking that night before the shoot. Turned up in the morning and he'd just got sober and... saw me and him. One, there was another guy in the band. They were four. He was 14 years sober, this other man, and they spent 3 days and nights persuading me I had a problem, and then took me to my first NA meeting in Dublin. Mm-hmm. So that was 1991.
Hard to say no to David Bowie.
Well, they did have to work quite hard to actually persuade me that, because I think we use substances for lots of different reasons, and it, you know, I work a lot with addiction now, and I think that quite a lot of us use substances to mask our pain. Some of us do it just because we're lonely. Some of us do it because we want to fit in. Some of us do it because it's what everybody else is doing. There's kind of all sorts of reasons why we do it. But some of us do it because we can't bear how we feel. And that's the thing I'm really interested in, is how much we can't bear how we feel, how unbearable reality can be for some people. Mm. And for me, that was why I used. And so getting sober actually was kind of nightmarish. I didn't sleep for 3 months, and it was just a huge sort of remembering for a very long time. It was awful. Mm-hmm. And I think I was probably insane. Took a long time to gently land. I think it probably took me the first 2 years of recovery where I really was deeply insane, and started working with therapists, and then... Gradually, things improved. I met my husband, the man I married, the father of my children. I met him very early on in recovery, and that was two insane people getting together. It was not a great thing, but we did it for a long time, and we had two children. And on a trip to India, so I got clean and sober in 12-step recovery, which basically says that addiction is a disease, which I don't like, actually. I don't like. I think addiction is a way for most of us of masking the pain that we feel within ourselves of shame and abandonment and rejection and all the things that happen when you're a kid, when it doesn't quite go how you think it should go.
You don't like it because it's disempowering to say it's a disease?
Yeah, I think it's highly disempowering. I think that if you say you're sick, you've got a disease, it's actually essentially, it's your fault. And actually, I don't know that, I think the problem with that is it just creates more shame. And I think that developmental trauma or gestational trauma or generational trauma or neglect or abandonment or any sort of abuse that you experience in growing up does actually really impact. No matter how much your parents love you, things can happen that mean that you don't find it easy. And the awful truth is actually that although I think when you experience that stuff growing up, which I certainly feel I did, you can feel like you're very alone and very isolated. I think the reality is actually there's a monumental number of people who experience that. Mm. So we have a monumental number of ways that we cope and issues that we bring to the table. Some of us hide them by using, you know, the top layer would be drugs and alcohol. But underneath that, we have self-harm, we have eating disorders, we have gambling. And gambling isn't going to William Hill and betting on a horse. Gambling is lots of things, including the money markets, that kind of stuff. Yep. We can have, food as in bulimia, obesity. And it keeps going on and on and on into some forms of depression, not catatonic depression, but the ways that we can really shut down and find ourselves very disconnected. And I think that to say that addiction is a disease basically says, you know, you're a bad person, you can fuck off and deal with it yourself, and we're not going to have any compassion for you. I'm sorry I swore on iTunes.
I don't mind you swear as much as you like.
But I don't think that to say that it's a disease does justice to the, I'm going to say suffering. Mm-hmm. Because I think that when we have internalized shame, when we have decided that we're bad, and what we do is we fold in on ourselves when we have a shame attack, when we get triggered into shame, and then we have mechanisms, like bulimia would be a real mechanism against shame. It's vomiting out the shame. Mm-hmm. With desperately longing for dopamine. So now we suddenly start veering over towards yoga. And I think that for me, I got sober in 91, and 12-step recovery was great. I wouldn't be sober without 12-step recovery. There's absolutely no question. It's an interesting discipline. It's a very clever, very, very clever discipline. I was reading this morning that 10% of Americans are in recovery, which I find mind-blowing. Mm. It hasn't been as successful here, 12-step recovery. I think we have we're more pragmatic in a way. We don't approach these things in the same way as English people, certainly. Going back to how I got to Kundalini, I was working. I lost my career in the film industry because I got sober. So I got sober, came back to London from Dublin, started going to meetings, and.
Why, because you took time off, or because...
No, because I was very much working.
You weren't hanging out
I was hanging out with people, and that whole thing was part of the hanging out with people. And so if I'm not doing it, I'm not one of those people that's going to hang out, and I can't be trusted all of a sudden. Even the, you know, it's a weird thing. You kind of, if you name it for yourself, then what almost happens is that reflection is seen all around you, where everyone's going, hang on a minute, if you're an addict, I'm an addict, and I'm not going there, I'm not playing.
It's probably also best not to be hanging out with them if you're...
No, exactly. You have to choose your company. Yeah. And then, of course, anybody who wouldn't use me because I was in that crowd didn't believe that I was sober. So actually what I basically did was I just created this sort of cataclysmic explosion in my life. And then I met my husband and got married and sort of did bits and pieces as a body painter, but I decided I wanted to be a photographer. And that was an interesting route to take. I tried to get into film school. I didn't want to go to film school. Wanted to be a photographer, went to India. And decided I wanted to take photographs of nomads. So I used the last of the money that I had from body painting. It was actually from my VAT account. And I bought myself a Hasselblad, which is not a digital camera. It's a medium format camera. It's the one that they take to the moon. It's modular, so it kind of comes apart into pieces. It's a very beautiful camera, and when you look into it, you look down into it. So you're taking a picture and then you're relating. It's a very interesting portrait camera because with the old ones, you look down into the picture and you're doing things and everything's the wrong way around. And then you relate to the person. So it creates quite an interesting energy. And I went to Ilford and asked them if they would sponsor me. Ilford made film at the time. It was before digital. So 1993, 4, 5, 6. And I went several times to India and did this amazing series of portraits, had articles in The Independent, had exhibitions at the Indian High Commission, and kind of reinvented myself. But on one of the trips that I was out in India, I'd been photographing nomads for weeks up in Gujarat and moving around with shepherds and a translator into places where they'd never seen a Westerner. And because I was a woman, I had the ability. They felt that they could dominate me, so they gave me more freedom because they could stop me if they felt like they wanted to. So I had a lot of freedom. I took amazing portraits in an area that was very soon after really devastated by that huge earthquake. So I photographed a lot of tribes that don't exist anymore, a lot of people. And it was really an extraordinary time. And on the last day of one of the trips, we were going to see the Ran of Kutch, which is this phenomenal place. It's 50 degrees all the time. It's salt flats. It's just nothing. I mean, it's nothing. There is nothing. It's huge flat land. And they have these mad donkeys. And I'd been there all this time, and I'd never seen the donkeys. So I got in the back of the truck. And there in the truck were two white people. And in all this time, I had never seen anyone white. And I sat next to the woman. The man was from the secret police. The woman was a stockbroker. And we didn't draw breath for 7 hours. It took a long time to find the donkeys. And came back to London, started a Kundalini yoga class in my house at 6:30 in the morning. I can't tell you how much I hated it. I really hated it.
You started it?
Yeah, I started a class in my house.
You started teaching it?
No, I invited her to teach. She was a Kundalini yoga teacher. Sorry, she was a Kundalini yoga teacher. We didn't draw breath. I invited her to teach. And she came every week, and there's a very large number of us who are very successful teachers who all started at the same time. There was a very famous gong player called Mark Swan who used to come every week, and he would come dressed as a different coloured chakra each week. And I actually really hated it at the beginning. I found it really difficult. I had a huge amount of anger, and it would bring it up. It would bring up all this stuff, but bit by bit I found that I was being changed almost against my will. I found myself able to inhabit myself. I found myself able to be in my body. I found myself able to bear some of the things I felt and certainly to look at them. And so I joined the first teacher training.
Let me stop you for a minute. Tell me what Kundalini is about. I've probably taken two classes in my lifetime. I've been teaching yoga for a couple decades. So I'm familiar with the yoga world, but I really don't know anything about Kundalini yoga.
Okay, so you've got several different things that come together in that conversation. So you've got the Kundalini.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? The Kundalini is in itself essentially the divine within.
Okay.
Yeah? So if you think about even the Christian concept of being born perfect, yeah? That you're born completely perfect and then experience changes you.
Mm-hmm.
And then come back to the whole thing that I was talking about of our childhood experiences, we internalize stuff. And then if you think about the energy of the chakras as they move up through the body, lots of different disciplines have lots of different senses, but we have these centralized energy areas that are quite relative to the root chakra being your history, the second chakra being your sexual organs, the third chakra being your belly. You know, they relate to how we manifest ourselves in the world. Mm-hmm. And so the Kundalini, essentially, teachings help you to understand that you compress yourself based on how you internalize your experiences. Yes? Can you hold that?
Yeah,
different things happen. Let's imagine, God forbid, one of your parents dies and you have issues around the heart. Or maybe nobody listened to you when you were a kid and you have lots of sore throats and lots of earaches and you internalize that.
All the ways we protect ourselves, defend ourselves.
Exactly, And they're all the things that somehow, they take away from that kind of innocence, you know, supposedly. I mean, the that we lose our ability to express ourselves in an unguarded way or to be really ourselves. We change ourselves, we form ourselves, we hold and contain ourselves to protect ourselves, to be wanted, to be approved of, to be liked. Yes, mm-hmm. We create a kind of false self. So the Kundalini, what we really want to do is if we can liberate this amazing energy, then we can experience ourselves outside of the dictates of how this straight, I'm pointing to the outside world, but how the outside world asks us to be. So we currently live in the 21st century where, you know, Facebook and narcissism and fashion and being really thin, really, really thin, seem to be, you know, appropriate. And then we measure ourselves against those things. Not everybody does. There'll be lots of people going, don't be ridiculous, I don't do Facebook. Lots of people don't. But we still have social mores against which, you know, I see lots of people around my where I live driving Jaguars. Mm-hmm. And obviously they drive up into these driveways and they feel very important. And so we regulate ourselves. We create identities that help us to feel more powerful, more important. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So if you think then about taking up a discipline that has postures in it and concepts and intentions that liberate you from, help to unlock, help to open, help to let go and release, then you have Kundalini yoga. Mm-hmm. And you can have Kundalini yoga as taught by Osho. Mm-hmm. You can have, which is sometimes interpreted as Kundalini shaking. You can have, various people have gone through and taken Kundalini yoga and turned it into other forms of, they're not necessarily naming it Kundalini yoga, but they've taken the awareness and the concepts. And then you also have Kundalini yoga as taught by Yogi Bhajan. Mm-hmm. And my early teacher was Yogi Bhajan. Mm-hmm. So when I first started...
So you spent time with him?
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, lots. And did lots of trainings with him. And he was a very interestingly charismatic man. Mm-hmm. And the thing with what makes Kundalini yoga, particularly as taught by Yogi Bhajan, because I've only experienced parts of others, so I can talk after 20 years of teaching about as taught by Yogi Bhajan, is you have intention. The power of your intention intensifies your posture by 10. So you're not just doing a posture like, imagine you've gone to the gym and you're cycling because you know that will speed your heart up, mm-hmm. and therefore that should burn fat. That's very simple. If I said to you, sit on the bike and do this posture and close your eyes and pull your tongue back and press it to the roof of your mouth, and now recognize that you're stimulating your sense of humor, you're stimulating your thymus, you're working natural antidepressant, you're burning off a lot of history. So if you take that into posture, an awareness, an intention, mm-hmm. before a class, the teacher should normally give a lecture, a talk, and contextualize the series that you're about to do, which then means that your intention intensifies your posture by 10. And then with Kundalini yoga, you bring together breath and posture. So you're not, although I teach pranayama separately because I love pranayama, I also teach Kundalini yoga as taught by Yogi Bhajan, and the thing that separates it from other forms of yoga is that you do posture and pranayama together. Mm-hmm. And then that is also said to intensify the posture by another 10. So you work in a sacred bubble and you set an intention, and then you are able to create change. You make a decision to create change, mm-hmm. in yourself. And for some people, it really, really works. I mean, I have a lot of people who come back and keep doing the classes because I'm really interested in empowerment.
Yeah.
Based on my past, I'm really interested in how do you get comfortable with yourself? How do you come to a place where you can bear yourself? And in those moments with postures, I'm very aware, because I'm a therapist, I'm a trauma therapist, I'm an addiction therapist, I'm a psychosexual therapist as well. I know what the hormones do. I know what the organs do. I understand how we internalize what we experience and then what the body does with it. So I can contextualize in a way that people can relate to, and you can really create a shift in your awareness of yourself, in your acceptance of yourself.
So for you, the Kundalini practice had a lot to do with your recovery, your healing.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very transformational. Yeah, and it's interesting because I did the first ever UK teacher training in the 90s. And I've taught since then. And actually, interestingly, I did mine pregnant. So I got pregnant, and then I did the whole teacher training pregnant, which meant I then also saw it from a very different place. And so I run this thing. I run a teacher training called The Mother's Journey. I train pregnancy yoga teachers to teach Kundalini yoga, which is very much about the mother's work in birthing a soul, which is a fascinating thing. And it's very much about ritual and ceremony in desire, pregnancy, and birth. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, to come back to the addictive nature, which does have its roots, I feel, in anxiety and depression and anger and low self-esteem and shame. Breath and posture, they're the only two ways. The breath specifically is almost the only way that you can regulate your mood. So when you start to understand the mechanisms in the body, when you start to understand, and it is what I've been fascinated by, mainly because of how I felt, I can completely change how I feel in 3 minutes. All we really want is dopamine. Mm-hmm. And there are certain postures that in 3 minutes will give you more dopamine than you've had in months. Mm-hmm. And if you understand how to approach those postures, if you understand as you sit there and do them, how to use your body and your intention and how to sit still, eyes closed afterwards, you don't need to go somewhere else to change how you feel. You can change how you feel. What I can't do is implant in anybody else the ability to remember. Mm-hmm. But I can give repeated experiences of how much agency you have over how you feel.
Do you have to do those postures and that breathing to achieve that state? Or does it get easier and more natural?
It gets easier and more natural. I mean, it's not just one thing. It's a really interesting thing. If we're looking at yoga, we're looking at the nervous system through the spine. We're looking at the hormone system. We're looking at what we're doing. You've got positive hormones and negative hormones. So you've got things like cortisol and adrenaline, which are, and testosterone. Although you need testosterone to be a deep-voiced man, or to be even to have sexual urges as a woman, you need testosterone. But too much testosterone and you can be very aggressive. And that can definitely affect how you respond when you are angry. And, you know, looking at how tired are your adrenals? How much do you live in a hypervigilant state? How much are you constantly hyper alert? And therefore, when you sit on the mat, can you trust yourself? Can you actually turn it all off? Can you actively, the thing I'm really fascinated by is the vagus nerve, can you calm down the vagus nerve? And in calming down the vagus nerve, totally change your experience of yourself. And if you do that, are you willing to let go of the power that the anxiety and the anger and the stress and the depression and the all the negative emotions allow you to wield in your life? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Because we create identities that allow us to control our reality.
Do you think it's important to complement if someone wants to grow, to change, to transform? Do you think it's important to complement your Kundalini yoga practice with something like therapy or some sort of relational exchange?
Define relational exchange?
So that because you can achieve all sorts of states. You can experience a bliss, or you can get that dopamine rush. And I'm wondering if through the practice, if you feel that the practice is sufficient, or if it needs to be contextualized with, you know, like therapy work that you do, or...
I think it's an interesting question. I've got clients who say, I don't want to talk, I just want to do posture. Mm-hmm. You think that's fine? No problem. Let's do one-to-one posture if that's what you want to do. It's fine. But come to a class as well. But then I also run training. So one of the things I've got actually coming up, but a big thing for me, is I run something called Master the Addictive Personality. And I run a week-long training or over 3 weekends, depending. There's one coming up that's a week-long training, and that is profoundly contextualized. I mean, really, it's a very intense exploration of what do you do? And so I've got a group of people. I think there'll be 15 people on this training. It's run with a non-disclosure agreement. It's not a non-disclosure agreement about what I say, but it's that they can't disclose what anyone else says mm-hmm. in the group. And it's a really intense shame work. So what is it that you're carrying? What are you? What have you internalized? So explore it, unpack.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really in-depth study of the vagus nerve, because when you understand what the body does when it's threatened, when you get triggered into shame, when you get triggered into anxiety, when you get triggered into shutting down and not being able to think, understanding what's happening, you can start to work with changing your whole response to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, it's vastly contextualized. There's a lot of meditation, there's a lot of posture, and it is a yoga teacher training.
Mm-hmm.
And you can either do it for a personal experience or you can do it to then go and teach. I have an agreement with a charity whereby you can then go and work in mm-hmm. prison and in rehab and actually start taking it out there. And I also run a mentoring system so that then you come back and retrain to teach, and mm-hmm. then it's yours to take out there, and you can keep teaching people, because I think it's the way forward. I'm teaching a thing on pranayama, so the workshop is anxiety and stress or pranayama.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when it's contextualized, you can make sense of it. You can do a yoga class and you can sort of think, oh, that feels quite nice. Or you can do a yoga class and you can be continuously in a state of reflection, even though ideally you're in your body, but you can be thinking, how interesting. In this moment, sitting on my mat, I can trust myself. I can trust that I can change how I feel. And that's, I don't know very much about you, so I don't know what you're like. Everybody says you're lovely, you seem lovely, but I don't know if underneath it all, you know, you have anxiety or fear or, you know, whatever, I have no idea.
Mm.
But if you do have that background of neglect or abuse or whatever, the fundamental issue is you will not trust yourself. That's the fundamental issue, because that's the internalization of shame. You don't trust yourself. So one of the things that doesn't matter what form of yoga it is, I know you're an amazing Mysore teacher, and in that ability to be still and experience that exquisite time on the mat, that's when you can think, isn't that interesting? I can change how I feel.
Mm.
Now, with intention and contextualized, you can point that out and someone can go, oh, isn't that interesting? I didn't realize that, yes, I feel really good and I've made myself feel really good.
Mm.
So I think that sometimes the contextualization expands the experience.
Yeah. It's useful for me to think about that because I... You know, I'm a normal human. I'm anxious from time to time, but I don't. My baseline state is not anxious, and I think I was just born that way. I didn't have a traumatic childhood. I had a lovely childhood, and I've had to learn that other people have a different experience of life, and that fundamental distrust that you're talking about of life is a lived experience for many people. Mm. So that was it's useful to get that feedback and realize that other people are living in that.
I think for me as a teacher, and I honestly, you know, I have to say that I think teaching here at Tri Yoga has been one of the most extraordinarily supportive experiences I've had in 20 years as a teacher. The space that I've been given to teach is wonderful. And the fact that so many people come back to classes, I've really taken on how important it is to trust oneself. I've really understood that actually that is one of the key things, is to help people understand that in that moment on the mat, however you get there, that ceremony of making that space and sitting down and choosing to trust, to go into it, is to begin to trust yourself. And I think that it doesn't really matter what style of yoga. I think as long as you have some way of framing what you're experiencing, and I'm quite bossy, you know, I say close your eyes, because I think that if you're going to do a really hard arm posture with 3 minutes of breath of fire, it's a killer. Mm. If you get to the end of that and you immediately open your eyes, A, you've missed the endorphin rush, which is just heaven beyond words. But also, it's a bit like rolling a joint and not smoking it. What the fuck's the point? Mm-hmm. You know? And actually, then if you do sit there with your eyes closed, it's just like, oh, my God, I can make myself feel incredible. The art then, of course, is coming back to that thing of I can't make anyone remember that they can do that. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately is their responsibility. And that's really the rub. Do you understand that expression? It's an English expression. The rub is the difficult part about it.
Yeah. Can I ask you a few silly questions about Kundalini?
Yeah.
What's with all the white and the
Turbans. Yeah, that's an interestingly difficult one. I don't wear a turban. Mm-hmm. And that does beg the feminist conversation. Mm-hmm. I don't see why I should cover my head. And I don't like covering my head. I'll cover my head to serve food.
But men and women do it, right?
Yeah, they do it, yeah. It's suggested that you cover your head, but that has been slightly more interpreted into you must. But it is only a suggestion, and I don't follow it. I think, like with anything, there is an option to be more fundamentalist about it. I'm not fundamentalist, and I think that again that comes back to that kind of feminist conversation about what is spiritual practice, mm-hmm. because most spiritual practice is defined by men, and therefore if you choose to be a feminist, then I really support you in taking apart your spiritual practice. Do what feels good for you, not because you want to be approved of by somebody. Mm-hmm. So if something feels right, do it. But don't do it because you think it's going to save you from hell, because hell is what you create inside yourself. It's not what you wear or not. Does that make sense?
Yes. say more about what the relationship between feminism and yoga for you.
Say more about the relationship between feminism and yoga. Well, here we are. Okay. There's a lot of male teachers, and particularly in Kundalini, there's a lot of male bosses.
And historically, yoga's been a male endeavor.
Yes.
But these days, I mean, 95% of the people that come to my classes are women. Most teachers I know are female.
Yeah.
And yet we're still working a lot.
Yeah, but it's interesting because because if since Yogi Bhajan died, there's been a marriage of Sikhism and Kundalini. Mm-hmm. And when he was alive, there was more permission for them to be separate. For me, with the kind of religious experiences I had as a child, I don't want to be told that I have to be religious mm-hmm. at all. And I don't want to be told how to behave, and I don't want to be approved of. I don't need to be approved of by a man. I know that's probably quite sort of feisty talk, but I don't need a man to tell me how I should behave or to regulate what I say. Mm-hmm. I know lots of women do, but I'm not at that age at all where it's relevant. And I think that we have the possibility of experiencing the self, the experience of Kundalini yoga, is to experience yourself in such an extraordinary state that you choose what you do with that. Why does somebody else have to tell you how to behave with that? You choose what you do with that. And I think that it's a tricky time.
So when you say that, what situations do you see where that's happening? Where are people coming to class and they're... Do you see a lot of people who come to your class still embedded in that kind of patriarchal?
I do, yes. I mean, I have a lot of people come to my class who do teach training. Mm. And the teacher training takes you back there. And this is feisty talk, and it's probably if anyone who's a grown-up in Kundalini yoga hears it, I'll be told my wrists will be smacked, but they're always being smacked because to me, I don't see why, as women, we need any man to tell us how to behave. I mean, why do you come to yoga? You come to yoga because you want to walk away from religion. Why do you then need somebody to tell you 10 men are saying this? Because the Sikh gurus... I think there's nothing wrong with the Sikh gurus. They're lovely. But I don't need to be defined by a man telling me that if I dress like this and I say this and I do this, I'll be okay. Mm-hmm. It doesn't compute. My brain goes bang. I feel like I've got Asperger's when that happens.
Yeah.
Just doesn't... And I teach a lot of women, but actually in my evening class, it's a quarter men, which is quite unusual. I teach huge numbers of people in a week. I run workshops, I run international trainings, and I definitely teach empowerment. And I definitely teach empowerment. And I think if, you know, homework, the homework I gave for anybody, you know, I'm on Facebook and people follow me, and I put the homework for Easter holidays was watch Suffragette.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a woman, watch Suffragette. And if you haven't watched Suffragette, then really you should watch Suffragette. You need to know what we fight for. You need to know actually how much is still happening.
Mm.
And why is that okay? And I think that we have this opportunity right now to do things really differently. And I think if you're constantly, constantly turning to some father figure to approve of you, you've really lost the plot. I mean, I know that's fighting talk, but...
No, that sounds very reasonable to me, and I think that, you know, yoga, all of the Eastern traditions come out of a very traditional background where those structures are in place, and when those practices came to the West and entered into our postmodern society.
They were bought by men.
Yes. And women.
Well, you've got Yogi Ashokananda. I mean, you've got, what's his name? Is it Ashokananda? Well, who's the man who wrote... he's got that place in Los Angeles with his giant koi carp. Is it... Paramahansa Yogananda.
Paramahansa Yogananda, yes. Back in the... He was, you know, he died in 1950.
But he was one of the earlier ones.
Yes.
Are the women who you can name who brought it
over? I'm talking about, you know, the whole hippie wave from the 60s and 70s. A lot of women went to India and to, to Southeast Asia and studied a lot of the Buddhists went that way, and not so much in the yoga tradition. But
no.
Yeah. But
have you read Yoni Shakti?
No.
She's written a very interesting book, which I guess is a doctoral thesis. I don't know. But it's a woman who... Yoni Shakti, her name escapes me, but she's an interesting English woman who has written a book about the history of yoga, and she very much frames it as a female-led practice, which men then took over. Which is an interesting take. I don't agree with everything she's said or written, but I'm not an Indian scholar.
Yeah.
But it's a very, very interesting book. And, you know, one of the things you asked about white, in Kundalini we're very much asked to be white. The white is the right side, the male side. And actually...
Is it associated with sattva, like...
Yes,
yeah.
It's associated with good.
Yeah,
it's being really spiritual. So it's this concept, which I do struggle with always, about coming out of the lower triangle, coming up to the higher triangle. Therefore, mm-hmm. Here we get round to sex. But of course, you know, the whole sexual thing, the whole female thing, the whole kind of energy of women and all of the kind of darkness that bubbles away there, you want to get away from. So you dress in white to be sort of pure. You dress in white to radiate this other energy. Well, actually, I think it's really interesting. I'm human. I want to accept my humanness. Gee whiz, you don't get much more human than me. I mean, I really feel very human. And so for me, to want to just come up, I'm already in my head. Why do I want to spend any more time there? I want to be able to be in my body, embody everything I've been through and be okay with it and actually be empowered by it. So I'm really interested in the other side as well, which means... Don't only tell me about the white. Tell me about the rest of it. Because the white is only one side. I want to know about the rest of it. And that is something I've explored for myself. And now I have a very intensely interesting relationship with Kali, which is to be very comfortable with the female side.
Mm-hmm.
And to be very comfortable with the Ida, the left nadi from the spine. To be very comfortable. I don't need to dress up in white to feel like I'm pure. I can feel just as comfortable. Here I sit.
You're wearing
completely
black.
In black. I've just come out of my class, changed my clothes. Here I am in black. And I wear black and red out of respect for that, because I think it's a very powerful aspect of the self, and I will not give it away.
Mm-hmm.
I will not diminish it. I will not try to pretend that I'm supposed to be good and pure. It comes back to that whole kind of culture of the Virgin Mary that says if you're not her, then you're bad and wrong, and mm-hmm. particularly for women. So it's an interesting thing, because yoga is, as you say, a very female-led practice. I think it's unfortunate that most of it takes place in very tight nylon.
Yeah. Yes. Well, that is... it's something I see a lot in our yoga culture, that it's especially a stage of when people are beginning their yoga journey. Everybody wants to be peaceful, and it seems to me it's quite rigid and narrow, and at a certain point, as you're starting to mature and accept everything about yourself, then that needs to include all of the shit and
yeah.
the, you know,
and that's the
pain.
Black.
And
yeah.
Yeah. And that is divine as well.
There's nothing more attractive, I think. And I don't necessarily mean sexually, but just attractive about somebody than somebody who totally accepts themselves.
Mm.
It's the most glorious thing to experience.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, it really is. To be with somebody who's just completely comfortable is heaven.
Mm.
So I think, yeah, that's the goal.
Yeah.
But there is an enormous amount of exhortation currently, certainly in the financial aspect of yoga, towards this extraordinarily kind of, yeah, nylon.
So what do you think most yogis are afraid of?
Good Lord. Afraid of?
Yeah, as we're talking about, you know, being embodied and... where are the places that you see the yoga cult, our yoga culture, missing the point or missing something?
I think that, I mean, that you're asking me to make a very sweeping judgmental statement.
Yes.
And I'm slightly reluctant to do that.
Okay.
But I think what I watch in all these years as a Kundalini yoga teacher, I watch an enormous amount of shame in the room. I watch an enormous amount of disconnection. I watch an enormous amount of self-harm. And I watch a really deep desire to be accepted in some way, and that creates this sort of... the giving up of the self to some surreal sort of human intercession, as if some other person can tell you you're okay. But nobody ever believes it, because if you've created this huge false self, you're not going to trust anyone anyway. I think a lot of people are very uncomfortable in their bodies. They're very uncomfortable in themselves. There is this, I don't think it's a really positive link between being thin and doing yoga. I mean, why do you have to be thin to do? I'm not thin. But I don't dress in nylon. I never have done. I don't have the body for it, and I certainly wouldn't find it comfortable. But I think if I did, then I'd really feel shame, actually. I think that... I think that people find it very difficult to trust themselves, in a way, and to trust that they are okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that if they don't conform to these really surreal identities that are somehow put outside, particularly female identities of being very, very thin and very, very rich and very, very blonde and very, very blah, 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 I think that's very difficult. And I don't only speak for myself. I think that is difficult. In a room, when you look in a room, in a teaching room, it's interesting to see the objectification.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a sense of creating the self as an object rather than the self as a person. And I think I would hope over time that what Kundalini does is it helps you become a person, not an object. Mm-hmm. Did that answer your question without
yes.
being...
judgmental?
Well, it's not... I have no reason or need to be judgmental, and I don't see that Kundalini rises over any other form of yoga. I mean, you've got to be quite open-minded to do Kundalini, really. Yeah. Because it is asking you to say, yes, I'm going to feel amazing. I'm going to feel exquisite. I'm going to open my heart and open my arms and do this and that. Mm-hmm. It's an eccentric practice. Mm-hmm. But for me, it still expands on a daily basis. It still expands, which I find kind of really interesting. I've never done anything for so long. Nor have I ever been able to maintain a sustained interest in something. I get bored very quickly. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I'm still here.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
Yeah.
I want to ask you one more thing, and I want to know a little bit more about your conscious sexuality work.
Yes. Okay.
What are those groups like? What are those workshops like? What are you exploring?
I run a weekend workshop called The Female Arousal Cycle, which is women only. And I explore on day one, it really does go into the darkness. It goes very deeply into what is the darkness? What do you carry? What's your history? What's your shame? What do you fear? What comes into your head when you're asked to be sexual? You know, what do you do around sex? What's the dark side of it? So it's very much an exploration as a group of that. And so a lot of shame work, a lot of work in groups together. And then the second day is very much more didactic. It's about teaching about the arousal cycle, teaching about masturbation, teaching about orgasm. If the group agrees, then it does end with a full breath orgasm, if the group wants to do it. But it's never hands-on.
It's a breath orgasm?
Breath orgasm. What's a breath orgasm? Lie on the floor and I will show you. It's a way of playing with the breath. It's a holotropic breath.
Okay.
So it releases DMT, dimethyltryptophan, from the brain into the body. And what is that film, When Harry Met Sally? You're not sort of lying there going, oh, oh. Well, you can. But actually, you just feel like the whole of your body is exploding.
It's kind of like rebirthing?
Kind of, yeah. It's a rebirthing breath, yeah. It's called holotropic breathing. But the weekend, I've had amazing feedback from the weekends. Women find it very liberating.
Sounds
to put
wonderful.
Down the stuff that's in the way. And I teach this in lots of different countries. And I deal with rape histories, sexual abuse histories, all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. Incest, there's amazing things come into the room. And there I would expect it. Mm-hmm. If I was to have a room where, what are the statistics? 1 in 3 women experience sexual abuse, mm-hmm. and 1 in 3 women don't orgasm. Mm. And so I would always expect in a room of 15 a pretty good negative sexual history. I mean, that sounds mean, good negative sexual history, but there will be a lot of stuff which I'm comfortable to hold. I'm a sex therapist, I'm a trauma therapist.
Yeah.
And we work with breath and understanding what the body's doing, and it's cool. Mm-hmm. It's funny too, actually. Very good homework.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, they're cool. They are cool. And then I work with Kundalini and trauma. I work with that as well, so a workshop on that. And I also have a workshop which is Gentleman, the Female Arousal Cycle, mm-hmm. which works with premature ejaculation and erectile dysfunction, as well as better understanding how
to... working with men?
Yes. Uh-huh. And then
only men?
Yeah, and helping men to understand how to work with their own arousal cycle, how it works and how to make friends, because a lot of men have a very disconnected relationship with their penis. I'm sorry, is iTunes okay with penis?
Penis.
But a lot of men have, they grow up believing that the penis is this kind of separate identity. And so embodying it is a thing, and working with anxiety, because the hormones of anxiety will kill an erection in a third of a second. Did mm-hmm. you know that?
I did.
I won't ask you how you knew. So, so I teach that kind of thing. And working with breath and posture, because the combination is amazing.
Have you ever worked with couples?
Yeah, I'm a couples therapist. I'm an advanced couples therapist. Uh-huh. So I haven't done any workshops with couples, but I'm working my way towards that, yeah. Because that's a whole other dynamic. You know, it's a different thing, but that's what I'm working my way towards. It's just gently building up. It's not a vastly approved of
work. No, it's a difficult area to get into. I mean, I really commend you for going there. It's not widely accepted, and it's so important. You know, we're all shut down sexually.
It's true. And also, I think it's very interesting, particularly in the aspects of yoga, that there's this concept of purity and that somehow one shouldn't be, you know, so people hold a lot of shame around porn use, you know? They actually start talking about porn use. Most women actually look at women on women porn, interestingly. And when you say that, everyone just goes, oh, okay, so I'm not that weird. opening it up and giving permission to talk about stuff that people never talk about. And there is some really, you know, it can be phenomenally painful emotionally. And that's quite scary for some people. But then it can also be, you get to the other end of it and it's just so liberating. It's so fantastically liberating. And I think when you bring together the psychology and posture and breath, you have really amazing transformation. You have keys. It's like being given keys to go, I can open that door. I can change this. I can do it differently. I can change how I feel. And this is okay. Giving permission for what you do to be okay, particularly things like a history of sexual abuse. It's, you know, if you were very groomed as a kid, whether you were a boy or a girl, as you grow up into being an adult, you can be very objectified. You really do make yourself into an object. Being watched is important. And therefore, really interesting to turn around sexual function and find how to marry that into a more positive experience of yourself. Mm-hmm. And that might be to accept the fact that maybe on a certain level, not on the tube or in Hyde Park, but you have exhibitionistic tendencies because that's how you were groomed. And therefore, that there is an element of arousal in there. How do you get comfortable with that? How does that become positive? That's an interesting way of working with history. I feel it's a real privilege to do what I do, which I hope I maintain a huge respect for the privilege.
Yeah. Sounds like you do.
I hope so. But it's also, it is controversial. And I say controversial things because I'm being, you know, I get told you can't say that. Trying to find somewhere to teach my workshops, that's a real bitch.
Yeah.
So I've ended up making a space actually at home. I have a really beautiful room where I run workshops because I don't have to, you know, everywhere I've approached has said no. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing hands-on. It's not like, and it's also interesting to pitch myself away from the kind of tendency now for apps and sex apps and orgies. And there's a lot of that stuff, especially as working in the field of sexuality. I'm nowhere near extreme. I mean, I know people who do much more extreme things than I do. Much, much, much more. Extreme in terms of hands-on and naked people in workshops. I don't want to go there. I'm interested in creating a comfortable state with the basics of sexual experience and finding a way to really empower that. And from there, I do teach about BDSM and I do teach about ecstasy, ecstatic states, and Kundalini yoga, which is also another workshop, which is fun. But that's really playing with endorphins and understanding how endorphins work and getting further, being able to take more and more and more, particularly women who've birthed, can take much greater levels of pain and pleasure. Any regrets for asking about that?
No, not at all. That's awesome. This has been great. I really enjoyed speaking to you.
You're lovely. I knew you were lovely. It's been very nice to be trapped in a very small room with you.
Thanks. Do you want to say anything about where people can find you?
I have an amazing website, which is my name, carolyncowan.com.
You've got a lot of videos on YouTube.
I have, actually. I have a huge number of videos. Thank you. Yeah, somebody counted the other day, 168 videos on YouTube. Yeah, so I have a free YouTube channel. And I have lots on Vimeo as well. So if you know how to spell Carolyn with a Y, then you can find lots of yoga, you can find lots of talks and lots of meditations and pranayamas and workshops. It's all there. You're very generous. Thank you.
Thank you.